Let's back up and see if you can turn that Mount Everest of manure into a few facts. Welcome to the Movie Ladder Podcast, where we're all about cinematic connections. Each week, we're discussing a movie that connects to the movie from the previous week's podcast. We're here a little bit early. My name is Zach Brooks, and I am joined by...
Brendan Fitzpatrick.
Last week, we talked about The Birds, and this week, due to a Alfred Hitchcock and a Tippi Hedren connection, we will be talking about Marnie. This movie came out 1 year after The Birds in 1964, yep. Birds 1963. Then at the end of the episode, we'll decide on our next movie based on connections sent in from you, the listeners, and us, your host. We will be spoiling Marnie as we get into it. So if you haven't had a chance to watch it, we'll put the timestamp in the description for this podcast. But you can pause this podcast, go watch the movie, and then listen to this discussion. I think we're going to have a pretty good discussion on this movie. Mm-hmm. You can find Marnie right now. It's streaming on Peacock, although it does have some commercials, or you can get it at the various rental sites as well, or your local library. So lots of ways to watch this one.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to be talking about this, and it's a really interesting connection. And really unfortunate timing, or fortunate and unfortunate, with the loss of Sean Connery on Halloween yesterday. Now you know when we're recording this. It's Sunday. I just want to express our condolences for Sean Connery, his family and friends. But it's really interesting to be talking about this movie this week, because I think this is a very different Sean Connery than a lot of people will have experienced in his other films, especially Bond, and really excited to talk about it. And,
yeah, no, it's definitely yeah. Fortuitous timing that I watched this movie like 12 hours before I heard that Sean Connery died. I think he might have died Friday. On the 30th, not on the 31st, but
okay. I remember waking up to the news yesterday morning. So
right, yeah. So I'm assuming it took a couple hours for that to come out. But yeah, apparently he had dementia, and he had been suffering from dementia for a while, and nobody knew about it. I mean, he had been off the grid.
He like had his own private bunker in the Caribbean where he was living and secluded, and yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting timing to talk about a Sean Connery movie, but this is early Sean Connery. I know, you know, people come at Sean Connery a little bit from different spots. You know, a lot of people know him as Bond. I feel like I knew him just from like the 90s movies. Like I knew older Sean Connery, and this was in the 90s when he was older Sean Connery. So it was always weird for me to go back and watch when I did watch some of the Bond movies earlier this year. I watched all of his movies and actually did a podcast about that a few months ago as well. And then to watch this one too, it's just interesting to see young Sean Connery where he's like hunky leading man and not like old grandpa Sean Connery.
Absolutely. And I think it's actually really interesting because I think I experienced old and young Sean Connery right around the same time. And neither of those things were in Bond movies. It was so coming from an Irish family, it's sort of tradition to watch Darby O'Gill and the Little People a lot. The Disney film Darby O'Gill and the Little People, Sean Connery is in that, and he plays the male romantic lead in that. And it's a very young Sean Connery. He has a thick Irish accent that he's putting on. And there's actually one of my favorite clips on YouTube that just makes me happy is him reaping crops and singing. And it's this song called Oh My Dear, My Darling One. And it's an Irish folk song, and it's very good. And then,
I've still never seen that movie. Maybe that will come up.
Darby O'Gill and the Little People is really fun. But you know, we may want to save that for like St. Patrick's Day, who knows?
Oh, yeah.
And then of course, my first experience with the older Connery was, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you know, where he plays, you know, Henry Jones Sr. to Harrison Ford's Indiana Jones. So yeah, it was interesting. I don't think I got to the Connery Bonds until my teens. And so my two Conneries were young, very young and very old Sean Connery.
Yeah,
and then of course like
for me,
The Rock and
I think The Rock was what was my first introduction to Sean Connery. I mean, I think I just kind of knew of him as like movie star, you know, because in the mid 90s he was in a whole bunch of dramas that I don't think I watched. Any of them, like Rising Sun and Just Cause, Medicine Man. Yeah. But I remember those movies, like playing at the movie theater. But I, you know, I feel like I really didn't see much of his movies. You know, even when I was younger, I remember watching The Rock, probably too young to be watching that, and Entrapment. Oh, and then Finding Forrester. But I also like didn't really come to the Indiana Jones movies until a lot later as well. So, yeah, it's you know, he's in a whole lot of different roles, and I think too, like watching this movie, yeah, this is Marnie is the type of movie that I definitely have not seen him in. I mean, he's hunky leading man, but not. This is almost like a the comparison I would make to this is almost like an Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, where he's like,
yeah, he's very dark. Yeah, yeah, he's very dark, very menacing. And speaking of dark and menacing, so Keith Phipps wrote a great piece for GQ.com as a obituary / tribute to Connery called Remembering the Dark Magnetism of Sean Connery. And I thought that it was really great. I highly recommend people seek it out. It's a really good read. And I thought that was really a fitting headline for this movie. I mean, Sean Connery has a very dark magnetism about him in Marnie, and you're not really sure what his intentions are through most of it. And it's really interesting. And I thought that was apt.
And I think we'll definitely, there's going to be a lot to chew on with this movie, with his performance and just with the movie in general. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once we get into that, and then we pick our connections. Of course, you know, if you want to submit your feedback, anything you want to submit your feedback on, either whether it's the movie that we pick at the end of this episode or just Sean Connery stories, or, you know, what you'll remember about Sean Connery. Yeah. You know, send it to us at Ladder Movie on Twitter or themovieladder@gmail.com, as well as you can get at each of us individually on Letterboxd and Twitter as well. So,
yeah.
Also, you know, before we get into best thing you've been watching this week, you know, also fortuitous timing, we covered the Birds last week, and last night on Saturday Night Live, they had a sketch all about the Birds.
That's right, they did. That was really funny. I really enjoyed it. It's, who is it? Kate McKinnon plays a very unhinged performance of Tippi Hedren in The Birds, and then John Mulaney shows up. He was the host this week. It's quite funny. There are complications that that arise from birds and other animals that begin to fly around. And I don't want to spoil, you know, if you have to explain a joke, it's no longer funny.
True.
So I don't want to over explain the sketch, but it's very fun. I highly recommend people check it out. I really like when Keenan comes on and does the classic theater bit where he's
roosting. And this was intended to be like a cut scene from the movie. But the cut scene is during the big when the gas station explodes during that scene in the Birds. So between, you know, that sketch on SNL, and then they had a sketch that was about The Fly, although that was before we recorded our podcast about The Fly. We're really in lockstep with SNL this season.
Yeah, apparently so. I don't mind it. And, you know, I mean, obviously Sean Connery was given quite the tribute / impression by Daryl Hammond in all of the SNL Jeopardy sketches. So, you know, he was a staple for a really long time of the Celebrity Jeopardy, and I think that's going to definitely be an enduring part of his legacy, for sure.
That might even be, I mean, sadly, that might be my major introduction into Sean Connery, is that performance. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell you for sure. I mean, I knew who Sean Connery was. That performance and that impression is right up there. Very good impression, as opposed to Jim Carrey's impression of Joe Biden.
Let's not talk about that. We'll zoom right past that, like a car speeding down the highway. Away from politics. Yeah,
like a racehorse. So.
Like a racehorse. Oh my God.
All right, well, before we get into Marnie, and, you know, after now we've talked a little bit about SNL, what was the best thing that you watched in the last week? Got anything nice and scary in there for Halloween?
So I watched a few different things, none of them particularly quote-unquote scary. I did watch last night one of my major David Fincher blind spots. I finally caught up with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Daniel Craig, which Mara's sister is it? Is it Rooney Mara?
Yes, that's Rooney. Yeah, Rooney Mara.
Kate Mara's House of Cards. Rooney Mara. Yeah. So Rooney Mara, Stellan Skarsgård gives a really fantastic performance. It's a really weird mystery. It's kind of a ghost story because it's a detective searching for someone who may or may not be dead and trying to solve this murder that may or may not have taken place 40 years ago. And he's hired by Christopher Plummer, which I thought was a really good performance from him, even though he's only in two scenes. It's really nice to when Christopher Plummer shows up to be, you know, the old man who has a mission for the lead character.
Like he's, an inside he's
done,
man.
Yeah, and he's done that a few times, you know, in the last 15 years or so. And that and the one, All the Money in the World, he did. He was that same.
That was one I never got around to seeing. Speaking of Zoe Barnes, that was the one that, what, Kevin Spacey was supposed to be in that?
Correct. And they, yeah, and they replaced him with Chris Plummer.
With
yeah.
Chris Plummer, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really liked it. Fincher has such a unique way of building tension and shooting tension that, like, even though it's not scary, it's intense. You know, like, and I mean, it's a lot like that with Seven and Zodiac and Fight Club, where you're not necessarily scared, but there's a lot of tension. And it was, I really enjoyed it. It was a really great, you know, Saturday night sitting on the couch, nothing better to do, watch. If you haven't caught up with it, Daniel Craig gives a really good performance as well.
Yeah, another actor who plays James.
Yeah, there you go. There's a good connection.
I saw that in the theater when it came out, and I remember being pretty unimpressed with it. I wasn't able to get into it really. But I mean, that was a long time. It was what, 2007 when that movie came out, I think. That would be an interesting one to revisit. I think it's also tough because that was a series of books, and the movie didn't do that well, and so they didn't make the other ones. At least the English versions, they didn't make the other one. I know
there is a Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest movie, but I believe that's the foreign version, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there were rumblings of Fincher making a sequel to that, and he just never did.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not. It definitely isn't breaking the top five of Fincher films for me or anything, but it's solid. It's you know, it's a solid, you know, good night of movie watching. You know, it's a solid 3.5 out of 5 if we're gonna rank it on our regular scale.
There you go.
You know, above average.
Maybe one of these days I'll get back to that one. I do feel like a lot of the Fincher movies I like better the second time than the first time.
Sometimes. That's fair, yeah.
Just because they're so dark.
That's fair. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, the best thing I watched this week was a group of plucky underdogs who nobody believed in that fought the big bad monster who lived down the street and came out victorious, because I am talking about the Michigan State Michigan football game yesterday.
I thought it was Monster Squad from
that. Yeah. that was the most, well, it wasn't enjoyable.
Wolverine's got nards.
Yeah, exactly. the best Wolverine movie was the Michigan State beating Michigan game. That was awesome. A very unexpected win.
Yeah. Tell me all about it.
Made for a very fun Halloween. So
nice.
But, you know, movie-wise, the best movie that I watched. Actually, like, I made up for last week, because last week I had not watched any movies, really. I think I had watched one. It was Borat 2. So this week I got in on the Halloween action. I watched a whole bunch of Nightmare on Elm Street. I watched the first three of those. Nice. I also watched Waking Life for my personal ladder. I guess Nightmare on Elm Street was also for my personal ladder. So I'm going to do kind of a 3-for-1 and just say that I watched Nightmare on Elm Street 1, 2, which is Freddy's Revenge, and 3, and really enjoyed all three of them. I thought they were – I had heard 3 was crazy, and 3 definitely gets very crazy. Mm-hmm. 2, from listener Kyle, also is my coworker, was telling me – he said, you got to watch 2. It's the gayest movie of all time, and it is very heavy-handed with the subtext that the character is a closeted gay man and the main character, and that it is manifested in, like, Freddy – coming out and making him do bad things. And it's, you know, I think at the time I feel like it probably was very homophobic at the time, but you know, Kyle was explaining to me that it's really kind of been co-opted by the gay community as like a symbol of pride. That
interesting.
Yeah, so
I guess I haven't seen that movie in so long that I never really thought about it, but
yeah, it's very, I mean, had he not mentioned it to me, it might have taken me a little bit longer to pick up on it. Once you pick up on it, it is very, very heavy-handed in that movie.
Interesting. I will say that Nightmare on Elm Street 2 has one of my all-time, like, creepiest, most horrifying shots in a movie. And it's the one where she falls asleep at school and she sees the body bag.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's I don't want to totally spoil it for anybody who's going to watch it, but there's a scene with a body bag, and it is terrifying. And it's like that shot used to haunt my nightmare dreams.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, because it's just like so scary.
Yeah.
For me,
and
anyways.
I think that, you know, for these movies, I had seen the first Nightmare on Elm Street a long time ago, and it was good to revisit that. There actually was some legit scary stuff in there. Like, I was surprised. Some of the stuff that was pretty scary, and I enjoy movies about dreams. I love Inception, Waking Life. I didn't like it as much as Inception, but you know, the idea that the killer is haunting your dreams and using nightmares to scare you instead of just being like a serial killer trying to murder you, it's a nice twist on that genre. So,
sure.
And then the third one takes place mostly in a psychiatric hospital. That's Dream Warriors, so that's a whole group that goes inside of the nightmare to try to take out Freddy. And
it's time to fight back.
Yeah, there were some great lines in that movie. I was talking to you as I was watching it, and it's wild, that one.
It's when they really lean into the campiness of Freddy in that movie. That's where he really starts with the quips. It's the quippiest of them, and then that's also where Freddy sort of turns from being a menacing villain into a camp comedy horror villain, you know. And it's a very big turn in the tone of those movies. The tone of the franchise, which they sort of co-opt and take back a little bit in a couple of the later ones, like New Nightmare. They try to sort of take it back and get it more serious again, and this is a long, first in a long stretch of Freddy being the quip master of horror movie villains.
Sure. Yeah, I thought about watching more of the series, and I just kind of, after watching three of them, I was just kind of burnt out. Like, I liked them, but I just didn't. I am assuming the quality dips quite a bit in as we keep going in the series. I've heard New Nightmare picks back up a little bit, but
New Nightmare is pretty good. Freddy versus Jason is kind of fun, but it's also like it's not very good, but it's fun. You know,
yeah, maybe those would be ones to save for Halloween 2021. Sure. So. Halloween might be over, but you can still get going with those Nightmare on Elm Street movies if you want. There's no rule about when you have to watch those movies. So, it was not where I was expecting my personal movie ladder to go, but Nightmare on Elm Street, there we are.
Well, funnily enough, Nightmare on Elm Street kind of connects to Marnie in a way, because she is haunted by dreams and nightmares.
True.
As characters.
And memories,
so. You know, I mean, that's a really interesting interesting connection there. Like, I mean, you could have just connected it to this week if you wanted to.
That's true. I thought a couple times as I was watching this movie about other movies I could have connected it to, other ones that were on my own personal movie ladder. And, you know, I think we can get into Marnie now. I mean, so and I don't even remember who suggested Marnie. It was Mac.
I believe it was Molly and Mac.
Yeah. Eminem suggested this. And I don't think we have a voicemail in from either of them.
Unfortunately, no, I don't think they got their feedback in time. But if Molly sends us a voicemail later this week, we'll include it on next week's show.
Yeah, we can include that. We just wanted to record this early because we didn't think that we would have any bandwidth to record this podcast Tuesday, like our normal Tuesday recording.
Yeah, for sure. I thought at first I was thinking it might be a nice distraction, but I think you are correct that it's better to do it now than
I also think, like, who's going to want to listen to this with everything Wednesday? Like, at least we can get it out Sunday night. People can listen to it Sunday night, Monday morning.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Or later on, but, yeah.
Right.
It is a – this is a romantic – I would say, like, a romantic thriller, even though
I think romantic thriller is a –
I don't know if it was technically a thriller when it came out. It's directed by Alfred Hitchcock, and it's about a couple – they become a couple, and Marnie, the title character, is played by Tippi Hedren, who was also in the Birds, and she enters a relationship with Sean Connery's character Rutland, and Marnie is on the run as she's committed different crimes. She's robbed different people, I think 5 different times, and so she starts working for Rutland and then enters a relationship with him, and Rutland is really trying to get to what makes her tick. What is why does she act the way that she acts? And we follow their relationship as it progresses between what she's going through and what he's trying to push her to get to.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, that relationship, because he sort of forces her against her will into the relationship through blackmail, because he basically says, if you don't do everything I want you to do in this relationship, I'm going to turn you over to the authorities and to the last guy she robbed, because that's how he figured out who she was, is because he had seen her previously at the last job she pulled, but right. She didn't recognize him. And so, you know, they apparently, the company that she robbed before she met Rutland,
yeah, that was
connected to Rutland's company, actually. So, yeah, Strutt.
Yeah, so I think Rutland does the taxes for Strutt's company, I believe.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah,
they have many clients, yeah.
And so Marnie is like a master of disguise. She changes her identity all the time. And I, you know, I feel like this is this type of character we've seen a lot in movies where it's the con person. I mean, you know, even if we get into Brothers Bloom, for example, yep. We've had con men
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels
yep.
Or even Memento deals with multiple identities and repressing memory. And that the consequences of both of those are dealt with in this movie. When your past comes back to haunt you, you know, because nobody can maintain a lie like this forever, unless you're Anthony Cooper, right?
Yeah, exactly. We're just going to connect to episode of Lost after this.
Yeah, I think we're connecting to Man from Tallahassee, right?
Yeah. Actually, no, I will say, to connect to a TV show, Marnie's character in this reminded me a lot of Nurse Mayflower on the season of Fargo.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
That was actually one of the ones where I said that I felt connections to this to different things. That connected a lot to the Fargo podcast that I'm doing right now, because there is a character who changes jobs all the time, changes her identity, and commits bad things.
And definitely has a severe personality disorder, much like Marnie does. We don't know necessarily what may trigger Nurse Mayflower, but we definitely know what triggers Marnie in this film. And
by the end of this movie, we do get that answer.
Yeah. And it's the color red right off the bat, and we don't really know why until the very end of this movie. But
the color red and also thunder as well.
Yeah, thunder and the color red. And quite honestly, Hitchcock did it to me too in this movie, because by the end of this movie, I hated the color red.
Oh, really?
Because every time she freaked out, he did like the bright red.
Yeah, the whole screen goes red. Yeah.
Screen red, and that was like burning my eye sockets every time.
Oh, wow.
Because of the color. Like, the color was so harsh.
Did you have your brightness turned way up on
your... I must have had my brightness turned up or something, because it was very bright, and like, I was like, yeah, I hate this too. No wonder. And it was like making my eyes bug out. But I thought it was a really, really cool use of color by Hitchcock to paint all the scenes in as much red as he could and get her reactions to it in really interesting ways, because and it's never the same every time either. I really like the first scene where we first sort of start to figure it out with her, when she goes to her mom's house and sees the red flowers.
But at that point, I still wasn't sure if it was the color red or if it was the flowers that set her off. And, you know, you talk about colors in this movie. So that was actually one of the very first notes I have on this movie is I just wrote down primary colors, because it's not just the color red. Right. In you see this in some Hitchcock movies where there's a lot of grays and a lot of muted tones.
Yeah.
But there are colors that really pop off the screen. So Marnie, when we first see her, she's at the train station and she's carrying a bright yellow bag with the money that she stole. And she's also has these like bright green shoes on as well. There's a key that's yellow that I wrote down. The taxi that drops her off at the beginning of the movie is Red Fox Tavern. So I don't know if that's from a restaurant, but the word red is right in there.
And the red
flowers as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the color red, but there really is just like color that pops off the screen throughout movie.
And I thought it was really interesting. I don't know if you thought this too, when I saw that shot from behind of her carrying the purse and it's sort of scrunched up in a weird shape, and it kind of looks like a fortune cookie.
Oh, I didn't
and
notice
I wasn't
that.
Sure if I wasn't sure if that was intentional or just the style of purse she had, you know, but I was like, okay, I wonder if that's going to mean something. or has some greater significance, that this purse looks like a fortune cookie. And
well, so I mean, I probably is a little bit of a stretch, but okay. What's in that bag is money, and the money leads to her relationship with Rutland, which leads to him blackmailing her and ultimately showing her what, you know, connecting her with her mother and finding out what it is that sets her off, like why she is the way that she is. So that money kind of is like a fortune for her. So maybe it's intentional. It's supposed to be a fortune cookie. I just think so, but I didn't pick up on it looking like a fortune cookie, but I do like that. I mean, if we want to apply something to it.
Fair enough. Yeah. I think it also maybe because fortune cookies are supposed to tell you something about your future or your life, or give you some sort of inner adage about like what your future prospects are. And you can kind of see that with Marnie to a degree is a character of severe misfortune. And every time she thinks something's about to go her way, the rug keeps getting pulled out from under her in this movie. And a lot to interaction of Rutland himself, because she basically thinks that she's going to be able to get away with all of this, and his constant not being able to let it go or let her go basically ends up driving her just as insane as she was. And anytime she sees the color red, he basically becomes the color red almost to her.
Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I think we haven't gotten a chance to talk about, but this movie, the leading man is Sean Connery, and you know, it's hunky Sean Connery. This is, you know, a few movies into him being James Bond, a hero. And so you see Sean and you expect that he's going to be this heroic leading man who sweeps her off her feet. Huh. And he's really not. I mean, he helps her unlock some stuff, but he blackmails her into getting married. He rapes her. He puts her under all this psychological pressure and really does terrible things to her. I mean, it's two bad people, really. I mean, it's one person who's bad as a result of this trauma from her past, and she robs people. And then another person who psychologically manipulates her.
Yeah, I mean, I think the term gaslighting gets thrown around a lot these days, but it definitely applies to this interaction and this relationship. He basically just psychologically and physically manipulates her into figuring out who she is, because I mean, he sets up this entire scenario where she's in her room and he's got someone knocking at the window while he's triggering her by standing in the doorway like her mother would, and like just freaking her the F out. And he's doing it on purpose. Like, he somehow figured out exactly how to trigger her. And it's the type of manipulation that, like, really does sort of classify this as a horror movie to a degree. It's the psychological horror that is really the most terrifying.
And he even uses these tactics. Like, he gets the horse for her, right? Yeah. So he does things to her to win her back. After he messes with her and he does these terrible things to her, then he brings the horse and she's back. You know, she's so thankful and she's back on his side. But then even having the horse ends up being an issue because she has to confront killing the horse, putting the horse out of its misery.
And even before that, she has to go on the fox hunt and she sees all the people in red jackets and that's when she freaks out and ends up having to ride the horse away, and the horse gets in an accident. Like, that was terrifying. That scene was really, 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 really scary. And I felt so bad for the horse, but like, at the same time, that's kind of what you have to do to a horse that breaks all its legs, unfortunately.
That's what it sounds like. I don't know horse culture, but
you know, I don't either. You know, but it's definitely really sad and terrifying. It's also a direct parallel between what she ends up having to do to the horse and what she did to her mom's lover. And so it's sort of like abuser. Yeah. I still wasn't completely clear on what that relationship was.
So her mom. Yeah, and I think we should at some point like dive into that whole flashback and everything that happens, because I thought that the last 20 minutes of this movie were really powerful when we do finally get the flashback and we have Marnie back in Baltimore with her at her mother's house. But my read on it was that Marnie's mother, she's a prostitute, and I think that she even says so much, and it's the sailors who come back to Baltimore that, you know, want a night with a woman. That was how she made her living. And then when this would happen, Marnie would have to go out into the hallway while the mother took the men into the bedroom. Right. And this man got abusive with Marnie's mother and then got abusive with Marnie also.
Right. Had I didn't notice that, yeah.
And then, you know, then it led to this incident. And and Marnie ultimately is the one who kills him with the fire poker.
Yeah, and we should say the sailor in the flashback played by the late, great Bruce Dern. So we'll talk about his other connections to other movies in our movie ladder later on. But the late, great Bruce Dern, thought he did a really good job in this, in being effectively awful in his one scene.
Yeah. And I did not know that was Bruce Dern until the movie's over.
I looked it up.
You can tell when you know it's him, but he does, much like Sean Connery, he looks so different than
Older.
But I did really like how that flashback also explained why Marnie's mother had a hurt leg, like why her leg was messed up.
What was messed up with her leg?
Yeah, because we do see that throughout the movie, but we didn't really know. So
for sure, because she has that scene early on where she's like, "Don't lean on my leg because you make my leg hurt," and now we know, again, why. And
and we don't know much about Marnie's mother either. We are told that or Marnie's father, I mean. We are told that Marnie's mother had her as a young girl.
Right.
But I mean, I guess the safe assumption is that Marnie's father was one of these men that Marnie's mother brought home.
I think that's quite possible, and that she was a product of, or maybe even a product of rape or sexual assault. We don't know. But I think that's a indication for sure, or at least an implied takeaway we can have is that Marnie most likely was a product of sexual assault on her mother.
So this movie really is much darker than most Hitchcock movies that I've seen.
Sure.
I guess you could, you know, maybe you could say Psycho gets dark like this. I think Rebecca also had some darkness like
parts
this.
Of Vertigo really do, especially with the trauma and the scene with the bell tower at the end that I won't get into to spoil, but it's parts of Vertigo also get dark. And I think a lot of the framing shots also used in Vertigo are also used here as far as shot composition and tension building and the way the camera moves around a character's head and through the wall. Is very similar to shots of Vertigo, especially the scene where she goes to open the safe to steal the money from Rutland and run away, and she can't do it because the camera does this really cool effect of like zooming in and out, in and out, in and out.
It depends on Vertigo. Your view of that. I don't know if I would call that effect very cool. I thought it was
very Vertigo.
So one thing, and once we get to feedback, we'll talk about this, I'm sure. But so I heard from Olin this week when he watched it, and he said there were two moments in this movie that made him that were not supposed to, but they made him laugh out loud, unintentionally made him laugh out loud. And so I was watching this movie trying to figure out what those two moments were, and we'll see if I'm right. But my guess, I haven't read his email yet. My guess is that the two moments were the zoom in and out on the money, and when the horse breaks its leg, because the way it's shot is just like very like dated and cheesy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, there's only so much you can do for effective shots in 1964, you know, with as far as special effects go. But I actually really liked the Vertigo effect because I thought it was very Hitchcock. It's a very Hitchcock use of camera.
But at least in Vertigo, he does the like zooming in while pulling the camera back to create that effect. This was like little kid with a camcorder going zoom and zoom out, zoom and zoom out, like fast. Like it reminded me of like home movies I would make when I was a kid.
Fair enough. I think without Tippi Hedren's reaction to it in the moment and everything happening with her trying to grab the money and then also being like super frightened of grabbing the money, I thought it actually helped really well, and I liked it.
Well, it definitely got through what's the message, or like what was going through in her mind
for
at
sure.
that point. Yeah. And I'm just looking at the cover art for Marnie, the picture from it, and in it, Sean Connery is wearing a bright red jacket on the movie art, which I didn't pick up on just now. So.
Oh, none in the one I'm looking at. Okay,
well, like the one on Letterboxd. Yeah, the one on Letterboxd, he's wearing a bright red jacket.
Yeah, he's wearing a blue jacket in the one on Wikipedia. But the background of the poster is red.
Okay.
So it's red with white and yellow lettering, and then Connery is wearing a blue tux with a black tie, which is weird. Mm. But
James Bond can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said this to our buddy Mac earlier, and I still think it's true. I mean, nobody quite rocks a suit like Sean Connery does. And there's one shot in this movie very specifically where he just has like this perfect suit on, and it's they open the door of the house and he's just standing there in the driveway in this perfectly cut gray suit. I'm like, oh my God, you're actually really fucking good looking, Sean Connery, right now. You know, that suit is just chef kiss emoji beautiful.
Oh man, yeah. I don't know. I can't tell you who wears a good suit. I can tell you who doesn't wear a good suit, but not who actually wears a suit. I'm just not that kind of gentleman. I'm not a distinguished gentleman like that. So.
Well, I definitely can't wear a suit like that.
I mean, we don't go anywhere. Why would you have to wear a suit these days? So, we did get our classic Hitchcock cameo very early on in the first scene.
Yeah. Yeah, he's coming out of the apartment door as she's going in.
Yep.
Yeah, or I guess that was a hotel.
Yeah, I think it was just the hotel where she stayed, and she's very stealing cool. the money. So, yep. And she did say that she's run this scam 5 times. Although Rutland was the 5th time, I think she said.
Yeah, Rutland would be the 5th, and I guess that makes her somewhat successful, except I have to think that there's a lot of... This was my problem, is that she's not a very good con artist because she didn't bother to put in the research between the Stotts gig and the Rutland gig to figure out if they were connected. And she then didn't bail after finding out they were connected. Like she went ahead with the robbery anyway. And if she was a con artist worth her salt, she would have just bailed as soon as she realized the connection and that she had already been made, because Connery makes her within like as soon as he brings her in for the job interview. Like,
yeah. And I don't know why is it just that he saw her and he was just so attracted to her? He was like, he's like obsessed and infatuated with her from the beginning that it's worth it for him to bring her in when she's
And it was also, I mean, because Stott had just talked to him about her in the scene before, after she robbed him and left. Like, Rutland came to Stott's office. I think it's Stott. Is it Stott?
Yeah.
Okay, Stott's office. And they...
Strutt's office.
I'm sorry. Sidney Strutt. So they went to Strutt's office, and he told him about the girl that used to work here. She had blonde hair. You met her, yada, yada. Or black wavy hair. And then, like, so he's already got a picture of her in his mind from the conversation with Strutt, and then when she walks in with the blonde hair, like, he still recognizes her because of the conversation that he had just had with Strutt. So, I mean, she should have bailed as soon as she realized that he had made her, and she didn't. And that's – we've seen some bumbling con artists in a few of our other movies that we've done on this ladder, and I don't know quite where she ranks amongst the – Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and the Brothers Bloom, but I think she's dead last for me as far as effectiveness as a con artist.
Well, she gets 5 of them. I mean, she doesn't get caught until the 5th one, and it's because she gets involved with Rutland.
Fair enough.
And, you know, that relationship does have its problems throughout the movie, obviously. But
for sure.
Even from the beginning, I mean, Rutland is her boss. And this reminded me of The Apartment, which I saw a few months ago, where you have this workplace inappropriate relationships that probably even 5 years ago, if you were to watch this movie, it might not have like made things red for you the way that like now you watch it and it's just like, you think about what the issues that Hollywood has had and just the issues that romance in the workplace has had and harassment in the workplace and dynamics. And, you know, Rutland is he's her boss. He's older than her, and he doesn't really give her much of a choice when the thunder starts and she's in his office and he just starts kissing her because
yeah,
she's
I mean, he gives her zero choice, and he, you know, he physically and sexually assaults her on multiple occasions, you could say,
right.
Not just the one big rape scene, but just all of his physical interactions with her, where he tries to kiss her, tries to hold her, and she gets so freaked out and can't do it, but he keeps trying anyway, which is, like, not for her benefit, it's for his own. And
right.
That's what really is probably the most troubling thing about Connery's character, is that I don't think he's trying to help her like, so that she really comes to this breakthrough and gets better, because if he really wanted that, he would have taken her to a actual psychiatrist.
Yeah, and I was going to ask what you thought his motivations were he forces her to go to her mother's house to
right.
confront her mother about the issues that she has and why Red sets her off and why these different things set her off,
right.
And doesn't really give her a choice but to address these issues.
Yeah, and it almost feels like some sort of sick revenge for her trying to con him. Like, I think that's part of what it is. It's like a power thing.
I do think it's a power thing, but I don't think it's that. I think what it is with her is that he wants to keep control over her. And so this is a way to exert control. I mean, he has control over knowing the crimes that she did, and he could turn her in at any moment. But also now he has control over her psychologically, and we don't know what happens at the end of this movie.
That's
right.
So
we, at the end of this movie, much like at the end of The Birds, they drive off, and we don't know what's next
for
them.
Sure.
And I actually kind of have one of my suggestions. I do think there is one more modern movie that feels like a very good connection to this movie, a very solid, and the movie almost could be the continuation of this movie after they drive off.
Interesting. Yeah, I've got a couple as well.
Yeah.
One of the things that I noticed, maybe this will be Olin's other shot from the movie that made him laugh, because it certainly did me, but so every time they drove up to Marnie's mom's house in Baltimore, there was that backdrop of a ship in the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, I was like, is that intentionally supposed to look like a backdrop of a set? Or is that supposed to actually be a ship? Because that looked awful.
It's
a terrible effect.
I think it was just a painted background.
Thought it was just a painted background? Because I thought maybe it was trying to be an actual, like, ship in the background. And I was like, that looks fake. I don't know if it's intentionally fake or not.
The budget and the time. You could connect that to Dick Tracy and the way the backdrops were painted at Dick Tracy.
Yeah, it just looked really bad.
Yeah, I didn't mind that. I actually really liked that, having spent a lot of time in Baltimore, to see, like, the old brick row house with the harbor in the background. It was some good Baltimore, I thought.
Fair enough. So,
all right, well, let's get into some of the other connections that we had. I mean, did you have anything else in general on this movie that you wanted to touch on?
I think just in general, also, it was really nice to have a real score again in a Hitchcock movie instead of the screeching score of Birds. But I really appreciated the Bernard Herrmann score. I thought it was really effective in building tension and playing drama. There were a couple spots where I thought the score didn't work as well, because it was trying to be super dramatic, a little over the top. But I did overall appreciate and really like the Bernard Herrmann score in this.
And
I thought all of the
too.
Performances were good. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, that score too. Like, I pulled that for last week for the end of the podcast. And so when the score was really good. And then when it started playing, it was like, I was like, oh, this sounds so familiar. That happens sometimes because I pull these scores for editing the podcast. And then I realized that it was only because I listened to it last week. I was editing.
That's funny.
I think for me, like, this was a fun one. I mean, this is not a fun movie. This is a very
dark
movie.
No, not at all.
But this was a fun movie to watch for the podcast because you and I both had not seen it. We didn't know anything about it except that it was a Hitchcock movie and it had Sean Connery and Tippi Hedren in it. And even until about halfway through the movie, I had no idea where the movie was going.
Yeah, and I really appreciated that, too. I was really glad I did not know where this movie was going at all.
Yeah.
It's really nice to have a movie that is a true blind spot come up on the podcast, and it to turn out to be a really good movie.
I think it was a really good movie, and I also think, like, it doesn't follow the traditional narrative path of many movies. So even when you're watching it, you know, you're seeing this relationship start blossoming. You see them, you see them grow. You see them get married when he blackmails her to get married. But you're still not quite sure where it's going, if they're going to commit a crime together. And then that this movie actually is, the whole thing is building up to her having this psychological breakthrough of her past. Yeah. I thought it was a really interesting plot for it to take and story for it to take. And also another TV show that reminded me a lot of is, there's an episode of Mr. Robot that has a similar type of psychological breakthrough reveal that is comes towards the end of that series. And I don't know if that episode was I would have to look back and see if that episode was inspired by Marnie. But it sure seems like it might have been.
Sure. I mean, and there are a lot of movies and TV shows that have played with the psychological trauma breakthrough, you know, and it's, and sometimes it's not good and sometimes it's done really well, like you were saying in Mr. Robot or in this movie here. I think it was really well done. And the one part that I would say I didn't think worked as well, or at least kind of like creeped me out and took me out of the moment, was her flashback voice being her little kid voice. That kind of bothered me a little.
It's still Tippi Hedren's voice. It's just she's talking like a
little girl. Right, she's talking like a child. And
Progressing. Right. And I think, and I actually, like, when we watched this, we were hoping to get a guest on. And we reached out to somebody who has a psychological background. I mean, I have a psychology degree, but I don't really have a psychological background, a psychiatric background. But the potential guest that we reached out to, I thought would have been really good because of that last scene, and just talking about just what in that scene, you know, outside of the trigger of Red, well, what else was going on in that scene? And I think that it actually seemed very accurate that when Marnie is discussing her past and what happened, that she's going back to that 5-year-old who committed this atrocity. She's just, her whole brain is going back to this moment.
Right. And I would be curious to know if that's how it works, or if that's sort of just something that only happens in movies. I'd be curious to hear from a professional as far as what actually happens when that sort of breakthrough happens. And I think our guest would have been very good at explaining that to us, because I also think that it would, you know, I would like some of our female listeners to reach out to us and send us some feedback for this movie, because we are just two straight white dudes talking about a movie that very heavily involves female psychological trauma as well as sexual assault. And I don't want to come off like we're just two dudes talking about this with no input from how it made a female listener or viewer feel. And so I would definitely like to hear from some of our female listeners if they have thoughts on this movie and can share a different perspective than we have.
Yeah, we did attempt to get a couple different female guests for this episode. And just with the scheduling, because we were trying to do this early, we just weren't able to pull it together. But yeah, I think that's definitely something that's definitely an aspect of it that, you know, we can come at it from the male perspective. And I would be curious, too, like, when this movie came out, like, was Rutland supposed to be the hero? Like, was it that he was like an anti-hero?
Well, he's definitely not a hero.
Right, was he? But like, I'm curious how Hitchcock viewed Rutland. He's not your traditional villain. And you know, in 1963, like a man who's, you know, somebody's like a woman's boss and is aggressive with his employee on a sexual level like that, like, it wouldn't have been viewed the same way that it is in 2020.
Right. And I think some of the information surrounding the casting and pre-production process of this movie would shed some light on that. I mean, initially Hitchcock wanted Princess Grace Kelly to come out of retirement and play Marnie. And I think she would have had a very different energy than Tippi Hedren does, because she's much more of a regal and stoic actress. So I think she would have played this very differently. And then also, it probably would have been her with Cary Grant, and Cary Grant would have played this much differently as well, I think. I don't think he would have been nearly as dark-humored and dark-looking and dark-feeling as Sean Connery is, because his natural go-to as an actor and leading man is suave, and I think he would have been much more smooth and subtle in his manipulations of the, in the role than I think Connery is here. So I think it would have been a very different dynamic, and it would have been a very different movie. And you might come away with it with Cary Grant going, well, maybe he isn't such a bad guy. Whereas with Sean Connery, he definitely is, and we don't have a doubt about that. I think you're predisposed to like Cary Grant, even though he usually is an asshole in movies.
But he's that classic leading man, which, you know, Sean Connery, outside of playing Bond, I don't really know of him being that type of role. So even I don't really even know of him being like a villain. I can't think of any movies where Sean Connery was a villain. That's why I said that, you know, Anthony Hopkins,
The Rock,
the comparison, but he wasn't the villain in The Rock.
Fair enough.
He was, Ed Harris was the villain in The Rock.
That's true. That's a good point. Well, Hitchcock offered the role to Grace Kelly. Initially, Princess Grace actually accepted the role, and then she read the script and realized that it would probably be a really bad idea and bad look for the Princess of Monaco to, one, be portraying a thief in a movie, and B, be sexually assaulted in a movie. And this movie actually went through three different writers. It's adapted from a book by
Winston Graham.
It went through three different adaptations. The first screenwriter was Joseph Stefano. He dropped out after some disagreements in the way the movie was being written with Hitchcock, some creative differences. And then Hitchcock brought in Evan Hunter, who also wrote The Birds, and they also had a falling out. Hunter actually begged Hitchcock to take out the rape scene between Ratford and
Rutledge.
Rutledge, sorry. Yeah, Rutland and Rutland,
yeah.
And Hitchcock refused, and Hunter walked from the project over that creative difference. And then they finally brought in J. Prescott Allen to finish the screenplay. And the interesting thing, and I didn't even realize this was really a thing, but I guess in pre-internet days, it's a lot easier to hire someone without them knowing that it went through rewrites beforehand. But none of the screenwriters knew that it had already been being worked on by a different screenwriter. Like, they had no knowledge of it until the movie came out that the other ones were involved. And so I guess that's something that you, like, nowadays you would just read about it on Twitter. Like, so-and-so dropped out and so-and-so is taking over writing. But you don't get that in 1964. So.
Well, it's kind of like art imitating life in that when Marnie is hired by all these places, they aren't able to do any kind of background check. They hire her without any references or anything like that because she's able to talk her way into the job. So it's sort of sort of a similar situation. Also, that's another way that she connects to Nurse Mayflower in Fargo.
Oh yeah, for sure, definitely. That's one
character who we haven't at all talked about yet is the character of Lil. And there is that dynamic between Lil and Rutland. You know, I don't think, at least for me, I didn't think it was Rutland's background was really clear in terms of like how he's connected to Lil. Was she his sister?
My understanding is it's his dead brother's wife, his dead brother's widow. Yeah.
Okay.
From what I gathered that from the conversation that they had after he hires Marnie, there's like a scene where he's talking to some of his other coworkers about his brother having died and his wife staying with him, and then we meet Lily. So
I would make sense that she's not his sister because she does seem like she has romantic. I mean, I guess she could be his sister and have romantic feelings for a brother. That wouldn't be surprising. But
it really reminded me of the relationship between Olivia Colman's character and what's his freaking name? Actor guy, Phantom Thread.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis in Phantom Thread. It really reminded me of that relationship.
Yeah, and Phantom Thread is very similar to Rebecca. So when Phantom Thread came out, a lot of people said that it was really based off of Rebecca, but it does have influences from a lot of other movies, and it would not surprise me if Marnie was one of the movies that Phantom Thread.
Because the relationship between Daniel Day-Lewis and the lead actress in Phantom Thread really does reflect a lot of this, because there's also psychological manipulation in that film as well. But I'm not recommending Phantom Thread from this.
I love Phantom Thread. I know you were not a Phantom Thread fan when it came out. I love Phantom Thread.
I wasn't a fan from Thread.
Oh man.
I really liked her performance, but I was really unclear. She reminded me a lot of Audrey Hepburn. Like, if this film had been made, like, 10 years earlier, Audrey Hepburn probably would have been in that part. Because she's got the same look. She's got the same short-cropped haircut that Audrey Hepburn would rock.
She did have that. I did think she had that look. And I too, you know, as we're talking about the different actresses in this movie, and the different actors in this movie, I thought Tippi Hedren did a really good job.
I thought she was so much better in this than she was in The Birds.
Much better in this than she was in The Birds. Like, her acting and her, even though, like, she's kind of over the top at times with her reaction to the color red and the things that trigger her, she does have that look in her eyes where you can see how upset she is. And I didn't think that she was able to portray that in The Birds outside of just being scary.
And I think a lot of that had to do with the, you know, prosthetic flying creatures that weren't really there flying at her. It's hard to play terror against a bad special effect or no effect at all.
The look that she has in this when she's just kind of, there are times when she's just kind of numb as being his prisoner, being Rutland's prisoner. So,
like, everything on the boat is just incredible powerhouse from her. And then, I thought the real showcase for her wasn't even the end scene. I thought it was the horse scene where she's at the door just begging the lady to give her a gun so she can shoot the horse. Like, that was, like, the most affecting part of her performance. Because you could just see the, like, horror in her eyes and her face. Like, it was a really well-done scene. And I will say, going back to Connery for a second, I have never seen a role where he doesn't really have his accent. So it was really surprising to me. And I thought he actually pulled off having an American non-accent pretty well. Like, I don't think it slipped at all. Did you notice any parts of his accent?
I did notice it a couple times. And I was like, it's weird that is he supposed to be playing an American? I was not sure.
Yeah, I think he was definitely playing an American. Because I think this takes place between Baltimore and Philadelphia. So. Everything with the fox hunt and everything is pure Pennsylvania.
Yeah. That's Philadelphia, and then she's from Baltimore. Yeah. I mean, but those places are not very far from each other.
Yeah. So there's a fun Connery connection in terms of
Let's get into connections.
One quick thing. The actress that played the mom, Miss Latham, is only 8 years older than Tippi Hedren. So that's actually a very similar age difference between what Sean Connery would later do with Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, where they're only actually 15 years apart. So I thought that was actually a really interesting connection. The actress that plays Tippi Hedren's mother is only 8 years older. I'm sorry, 15 years older than her daughter. So I thought that was really interesting.
And while we didn't do Last Crusade, we did do Raiders of the Lost Ark.
We did.
So, I mean, that does sort of connect to Raiders of the Lost Ark in a roundabout way.
Yeah, in a weird roundabout way. I wrote down a few connections. Let me scroll down and see what we got. So, we obviously talked about how we thought this stacked up against some of our other con artist movies, including Brothers Bloom, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. There is a lot in this movie that deals with repressed memory. Mm-hmm. And I think I even said to you, like, 15 minutes into this movie, I texted you and said, this movie, for some reason, reminds me a lot of Shutter Island. And then I didn't realize how prescient that would be until the end of the movie. And it's,
I didn't even really think of Shutter Island as a connection to the movie. But
Shutter Island is all about maintaining a narrative in order to bring about repressed memories. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I kind of expected at the end Sean Connery to, like, whip out a white coat and put it on, and the white coat to say Dr. Rutherford or Rutland or whatever. Like this whole thing was a play to get her to unleash her memories.
That's true.
So I was waiting for that part of the twist, like, for that to possibly be a twist, that all of this was sort of happening in her head at some sort of mental institution.
Yeah, that would, the 90s version of this movie, that might have been what the twist was.
For sure. But it's definitely Shutter Island. Like,
I think too, like, just connections to the birds, you know, before we go on to other movies. Like, there, you know, there's obviously the Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren connection. There's some thematic connections, like problematic relationships with a lover and also problematic relationships with a mother.
Because all the best Hitchcocks have mommy issues.
Right, exactly. Yeah, every single one has some kind of problematic mother. And then this their relationship. I mean, the relationship with the birds wasn't quite as problematic as this, but it was kind of a stalkery. It wasn't a traditional relationship.
Yeah, instead of a fight over making and bringing tea, it's a pecan pie. And then there's the awkward relationship between, you know, Rod Taylor's mother and the daughter / sister, and then how that relationship interacts with and intersects with when Tippi Hedren shows up in that movie and the taking away of my child and all that.
Probably track Lil's character also in her attempt to be controlling of Rutland over. You know, I think that some of the stuff with Rod Taylor's mother, and then also the Carol, the annoying little girl. There was an annoying little girl character that really never came back up in the movie early on.
Yeah, Jesse.
Yeah, Jesse.
Jesse the girl.
I also so Rutland talked about when they're on the boat and they're on their honeymoon on that cruise. He's talking about the birds and the insects.
Yep. And he's actually reading a book. I wrote down the title of the book. It's Animals of the Seashore, which basically it's a book about birds. It's a book about birds.
Yeah.
It's Animals of the Seashore. And that's what we got in the birds. So, yeah, there you go. Very, very, very subtle there, Hitchcock.
Yeah.
One thing I really – so we talked about the Bernard Herrmann score and that we both really liked it. Bernard Herrmann also did the score for the birds. And not only did he do the score for The Birds, but he did the score for many of Orson Welles' movies, including Citizen Kane.
Oh.
So there we go.
And I did – there's definitely a Citizen Kane in terms of the relationship that that Charles Foster had with his wife and, kind of like living in this big Victorian mansion together.
Yep.
There's that as well. This movie also ends with the characters driving off to the unknown.
Yep.
And so that's what we get at the end of The Birds and probably in other movies too. I'm sure we have other movies where we have people driving off into the unknown that we've talked about. It's like set it off at the end of the movie. She's driving into the unknown.
Yeah, she's on a bus though, right? Yeah.
Yeah, she was on a bus.
Yeah, something like that. And then
and
we also got a diner scene. We get diner scenes in most of our movies.
That's true. This movie opened with a train. Opened with the train station. And The Birds opened with the trolley car going across, and then we have had trains in a lot of our movies as well.
Love train movies.
So, also Bruce Dern was in this movie, and Bruce Dern was also in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yep. So he pops up in a minor role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and then the horseback riding and everything also connects to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. As well as, do we have any other horseback riding movies? Do they ride horseback in Brothers Bloom?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe Phil rode a horse in Groundhog
Day. There's a bridge jump in The Great Escape. Or a wall jump, I mean. And then, luckily they make it in Great Escape, but the horse does not make it here.
That's true. A couple other things that I wrote down too. The color red being a significant color. We talked a lot about that with Beetlejuice.
The thin red line.
And the thin red line, yep. And the boat scene reminded me of Brothers Bloom when we've had a couple movies with boats, but that specifically when they're on that cruise ship in Brothers Bloom, conman on a boat. The pool suicide attempt was like Harold and Maude.
Yep.
And we had a wedding, so that reminded me of Beetlejuice, also Hamilton. I don't know if there were other weddings, but I know Beetlejuice and Hamilton both had weddings in it.
Absolutely.
I think we talked about weddings recently. So I feel like there were other – I mean, Citizen Kane probably had a wedding or did have a wedding. And Harold and Maude attempted to have a wedding but was not successful. So, and then the last one that I wrote down that was the last one I wrote down. Oh, no, also based on a book as well.
Yeah. And
we had a lot of movies based on books.
Yeah, we have had a lot of movies based on books.
You could map that onto a lot of movies in general, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And then you could kind of map the relationship of Rutland and Marnie to the relationship between Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt in Interview with the Vampire, where Tom Cruise basically manipulates Brad Pitt into becoming a vampire and then won't let him go.
Oh yeah,
You know,
I
it's
didn't really
sort
think
of
about that, but yeah.
thematically similar relationship as far as the psychological abuse and then the physical abuse as well, between those two movies.
Yeah. Creepy, you have a creepy romantic advance, which reminded me of Top Gun.
Yeah, there you
The
go.
scene in the bathroom.
For sure. And then yeah, I mean, we have all our diner scenes in all our movies that we love so much.
Yeah, take your pick.
Yeah, take your pick, My
Dick
Cousin
Tracy,
Vinny.
Set It Off. Yeah, My Cousin Vinny, Reservoir Dogs, Fargo.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
All right.
And oh, I guess, if you wanted to say movies starring people who played James Bond, or
Yeah.
not starring, but including Timothy Dalton was in Hot Fuzz as
Oh
well.
yeah, good point.
So,
There you
I
go.
think that's the only other Bond appearance. I don't think we've had Pierce Brosnan in anything that I can remember, or Roger Moore, or Daniel Craig.
Not yet. No.
Maybe soon. So, all right, what do you got for feedback from people?
Yeah, let me flip over to the feedback. I lost my mouse.
I can start.
Here
All
we
right,
go.
so Jeff wrote in, and he said, "This is a very strange movie. I really couldn't figure out why Rutland wanted to hire her, knowing who she was and what she did. Then he supposedly falls in love with her, but I think he's planning all along to see what makes her tick to satisfy his own curiosity. As Zach said, he's kind of a monster. Really never cared about any of the characters except for Lil." Oh, he cared about Lil. Okay.
He did care about him.
And maybe Father Rutland, aka Alfred from Batman. Oh, I didn't realize that was Alfred.
Oh yeah.
Which Alfred? Is that from the 1989 Batman?
It's the Batman, the Adam West Batman.
Oh, the 60s version. Oh,
Yeah,
that's a fun
60s
one.
Batman.
Okay. He said he really didn't love the movie overall, but it wasn't the worst that I've seen. I laughed out loud every time they did the horseback riding sequence. Yes. And again,
Everybody
the
did.
technology wasn't there, but it's so bad that they could have been a little bit better cutting it. I give it 2.5. So, some of that stuff you just kind of take that
Yeah,
with a
I mean,
grain of
that's a product of the times. I can't really knock it for not having, 1990s or 2000s level CGI, They didn't have that back then, so they did the
Do you
best
think
they could.
they would remake this movie?
I'm kind of shocked that they
I mean,
haven't.
they just did Rebecca, which got panned.
Yeah. It feels like
Rebecca's very.
there has to be a modern version of this movie that's just not called Marnie.
That's true. Actually, one of my connections, I guess you could say, is that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also think so. The movie Mission Impossible 2 is actually
Yeah.
very similar to another Hitchcock movie that I won't. I don't really want to spoil because I don't want to spoil like the plot of different Hitchcock movies.
Sure.
But there's a certain Hitchcock movie that when you watch it, you're like, oh, this plot of Mission Impossible 2, there is a big portion of Mission Impossible that's similar to this. Well, Mission Impossible 2 also has a big scene that takes place at a horse track.
Wow.
And I feel like that if they were using one Hitchcock movie for that, maybe they were also borrowing from Marnie for the horse track scene.
Yeah, true.
All right. What else we got? You find your mouse?
I did. So we're scrolling up to Jim. Jim wrote in to say, Marnie was enjoyable, though the 60s psychology and effects are a little distracting. Tippi Hedren and Sean Connery are both good. He's giving Marnie a 4. And then Owen writes in to say, my big question from this film, do people in the South pronounce insurance the way that Sean Connery says they do in this movie? Got a big unexpected laugh from that. I didn't really notice that. Did you notice how he says insurance?
No, I didn't notice that at
I
all.
didn't notice it either. It's, interesting. The way he said insurance. So got a big unexpected laugh from that. Similar laughter at Marnie being thrown off the horse with how haphazardly it was shot. Yeah, he wrote house. I think he meant horse.
Yeah, it was like, wait, was she thrown off of a house? Okay,
Yeah.
so I was kind of
So
right
yeah.
on one of my predictions about what made him
Yeah,
laugh.
definitely the horse scene.
I'm surprised he didn't laugh at the zoom in and out of the money. That was so ridiculous looking.
Well, he's got more here. Maybe we'll get to it. Didn't feel any build up of suspense or growth at all. Was just a bit jumpy when story needed to shift to the next phase. Bit of a dull soap opera melodrama trying to be held together by the actors' charisma and the score. Lead actors were good, and the score probably held it together. Nice link with the birds after doing a Hitchcock film with the man who turned down playing James Bond, Rod Taylor. It's appropriate to have a film with the man who took the role from Rod Taylor. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Rod Taylor was initially supposed to be Bond.
Oh, yeah. Did you know that? I did not know that. I'm surprised Mac didn't bring that up. And yeah. I'm glad that Sean Connery got it and not Rod Taylor.
Yeah, for sure. So he Owen gives it a 2.5. We'll have to fact check that James Bond note with Mac later and let you guys know. So that's going to give us an average of 3 from the listeners.
Okay.
I'm kind of shocked how low the listeners are on this movie. Aside from Jim, I actually thought this was really good. Like, I want to give this movie a 4.5. Like, I think this is one of the better movies we've watched recently. And I know I'm normally an average high scorer, and that I sort of get really excited and way too invested in a lot of the movies we watch and don't tend to give very low scores. But I also don't give low scores to things that don't deserve it. And right. I don't think this deserves a low score at all. In fact, I am going to give it a 4.5 because I found the psychology to be interesting, the performances to be really good. The manipulation and unexpected way the plot took me to get to the end game was really, really interesting. The only thing you could really knock it for are some of the effects and maybe the plot logic didn't quite work of how they got intertwined in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if she was a really good con artist, she would have just walked instead of trying to pull it off before she left. But I still got to give it a 4.5 just for the performances and the score and the way it was shot. I thought it was one framing thing we didn't touch on. I really enjoyed the scene where she is stealing from Rutland, very first one, where it's the camera is set up with a split screen between the janitor on one side and her on the other side of the wall. And then the way that was played in complete silence as well, with zero score under it, I thought was really, really well done, and I really loved that scene.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I wrote that down in my notes as well, that was a really cool scene that they have that wall that works as a divider to split the screen in half. And I feel like we've had that in another movie, and I cannot tell you what movie it was.
And it's a classic Hitchcock thing. He loves
Watched, but I feel like we've definitely watched something where we had a split screen like that. And I cannot remember. Maybe Citizen Kane had some of that.
That definitely happened in Citizen Kane, and that also definitely happened in Brothers Bloom, I feel like.
And Hamilton had the song. I don't remember what song it was, but there's the song where Hamilton and Burr are both singing and they're sitting in the chambers kind of side by side. There's nothing actually dividing them, but it is a split screen between them.
Yeah.
So, I'm glad you brought that up too, because I thought that was definitely one of the better scenes in this movie, and we didn't get a chance to talk on that. I'm surprised the listeners are so low, and I think it's okay that we have higher scores, because we don't pick bad movies, right? Like, it's the same way when if I'm grading episodes of Lost, like, usually my score is high because episodes of Lost are good, and correct. So like, I'm not gonna have low scores because the episodes aren't bad for the most part. Exactly. And I do think outside of a couple movies, we've picked good movies, and I definitely prefer the cheese of Marnie to the cheese of the birds, and I think overall, I didn't give the birds a very high score. I did like Marnie quite a bit. I don't know if I'm quite high enough to do the 4.5 like you. I think I'm closer to a 4, somewhere in between a 4 and a 4.5. But, I think it was the only reason why I'm really knocking it down is just because there were things, especially in the first half, that made it a little hard to follow, why certain people were doing things, who these different characters were, how they were connected, how is Neil connected, what's the connection between Rutland and Strut. But I did think that there were some really tense scenes, and I didn't know where the movie was going. I actually ended up watching the second half, most of the second half again after I finished it, just to try to pick up a couple other things. And it's definitely a rewatchable movie. I don't know if I would choose to rewatch this because it's so dark, but I think that it plays well if you watch it knowing where it's going, and you can see some of the stuff they're setting up early on. So I'm giving it a 4. And Tippi Hedren, I think, did a really good job in this, and I just want to give her props. And I thought Connery was good in this kind of leading man role, and it's a good week to watch a Connery movie. I do want to just touch on, and I just was not able to get the backstory on it, but I do think there was some inappropriate relationship going on between Tippi Hedren and Alfred Hitchcock as well.
And that is the focus of a movie that one of our listeners suggested, and I don't we'll get there in connections. Yeah, they had a very inappropriate relationship, apparently.
Right. And I do think I am viewing this through a 2020 lens, and I'm not sure if Alfred Hitchcock was making – I mean, he obviously wasn't making this through a 2020 lens, but I'm not sure if he saw the problematic stuff in the relationship that I see, but it still plays fine. It works, and it touches on current event type issues. So, I don't know why they left the keys. They made the keys to the safe really easy to find.
Definitely didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out how to rob those safes.
Right.
For sure.
Good movie all around. I really enjoyed this, and I'm excited to see what kind of, I think we can do some really good connections off of it, so I am excited for that.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So between the 4 from me, the 4.5 from you, the 3 from the listeners, what does that average us to?
That's going
to
give us a 3.83, which will round up for a 4 to a 4 for the purposes of Letterboxd.
Yeah. And I'll be interested too. I mean, we are recording this early. I know we have some regular listeners that didn't get a chance to send in their grades yet.
Yeah, so, we definitely want to hear from you next week. Like, send it in with the next movie.
Right. And so we might give like a mail-in voting situation where we're declaring right now that it's a 4, but once we get the mail-in votes, it might go up to a 4.5.
We're happy to adjust. We are a democracy on the Movie Ladder podcast.
Yes, exactly.
Democracy Now.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's see what we're going to be watching next week. Let's get into our Movie Ladder and the connections that we're sending from the listeners and from us, the host. Of course, we always listen to, or we always have connections from our listeners. We pick our we've been doing Final Four. We don't have as many connections, so maybe we can see once we get them if we want to see if we want to do Final Four, if we just want to do Final Two.
Let's do the Final Four. That's fun.
All right, cool. Yeah, it gets more. It's like in Survivor, having an extra person gets more.
Exactly. And then we put them all into fire making and
right. So, all right. So, Jeff sent in all Connery connections. I was kind of expecting we'll get a lot of Connery connections this week.
Fine by that.
He said Hunt for Red October.
Mm-hmm.
If a lot of other people are going to suggest that with Sean Connery.
Based on a book.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Based on a book as well. Then there's also A Bridge Too Far, which I've never seen A Bridge Too Far. I don't know anything about it.
I haven't either. I believe it's a World War II movie, unless I'm thinking of something else.
Okay. And then the last one he suggested is The Rock. And The Rock would be very fun to do.
I like The Rock. I'm a big fan. Yeah,
I'm a big fan.
You smell what The Rock is cooking?
Yeah. And then Jim sent in also Sean Connery. He said The Untouchables. Sean Connery investigating a crime.
Yep. I love The Untouchables. The Untouchables is very fun.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen that as well.
Really solid Robert De Niro performance as Al Capone. Lots of enthusiasms.
So and then Olin sent in Don't Look Now, psychological thriller with a strong motif of the color red, with red popping up so much, it was a natural link, just like last week. And he also suggested The Girl from 2012, a film about the relationship between Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren, starring Toby Jones and Sienna Miller. Ooh, that – okay, so there's an actual movie about that.
I was referencing earlier, yeah.
Okay. I do not know anything about The Girl, but that would be –
Don't either.
That would be like an interesting capper to this trilogy.
Yeah, it would. I would be very interested in doing that.
And then Olin also sent in The Rules from 1978. Rutland, the name of Connery's character. Yep. Rutland is also where Ruttles are from. English.
I believe it's the Ruttles.
Oh, the Ruttles. My bad.
The Ruttles.
England's smallest country, who got their big break on Rutland Weekend Television. Eric Idle and Neil Innes during spoof to the Beatles. The Ruttles.
Yeah, it sounds like a sort of a pre-Spinal Tap, Spinal Tap.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we had a special request from my mother,
ooh,
who has not seen Marty in forever and was very freaked out that we were doing The Birds because she saw it once and said she would never see it again. And she was like, I can't stand to even look at an image from that movie because Tippi Hedren's performance was just terrifying. Birds are just terrifying to me. So, but she did message me and say that she really thought that we should do Double Indemnity.
This one has come up a lot and has been on my watch list for a long time. Yeah.
So murder, fraud, and blackmail would be the connection to Double Indemnity. So there you go.
Cool. All right. Well, let's see what we've got from us as well.
Yes.
Let's see. You went first last week, I believe, right?
I did. So you should go first.
So it's my turn to go first this week. All right. Sure. So, you know, as I was watching this movie, I feel like I could have come up with more. I just wasn't able to think through the themes as much, but I did write down just some themes of movies that I wanted to get. And I don't know if I necessarily had that many. I wrote down Bad Marriage, Honeymoon, and Obsession, and also like Cat Burglar, you know, con artist type thing. I don't think I had great results with those, but I do feel like I have some good suggestions. So the first is we can stay on the Hitchcock train, literally, and do a movie that is Strangers on a Train, a movie about partners in crime. Because we really do have between, you know, Rutland is also criminal. I mean, they reference the money that Rutland has embezzled or stolen throughout this movie. So both of them are partners in crime. There's another one that I have that I believe is on your list, so I will punt that one to you. Is that one? Because I have other ones. So because of the horse, I put two recent horse movies on my list that I had on my watch list, and I just heard they're good. I don't know much about them. One is Lean on Pete. And the other is The Rider. So both are movies about horses, and both are supposed to have very good – I know the Film Spotting guys like those a lot.
I've heard good things on both of those from Film Spotting.
The Rider, I believe the director of The Rider just did another movie that came out. This is great podcasting. Do you remember who did The Rider?
It's not Kelly Reichardt?
No, Chloe Zhao. Who else is doing The Eternals? And Lean on Pete, I think was...
Chloe Zhao did just come out with a movie this year as well, right?
And Lean on Pete, nothing. The guy who did Lean on Pete hasn't done really anything else that I've heard of. Chloe Zhao also did Nomadland as well.
That's what it is.
Which I haven't seen that either.
I haven't either. That's the new Frances McDormand that's supposed to come to streaming sometime this month.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know if horses is a good enough connection for either of those movies, but because I just don't know if there's other connections. And then the last one, this is the one that I've teased throughout the movie. So this is the movie that I really feel like is the modern retelling of Marnie, and could be like after they drive off at the end of Marnie, this could be where that relationship goes if it was transported, you know, 40 years into the future. So this is a movie that I saw recently. It came out a couple years ago. It stars Ben Affleck and I'm gonna have to edit this because what is her name? So the movie is Gone Girl. So speaking of David Fincher, Rosamund Pike. That's who's.
Rosamund Pike. Very good.
So another one about a marriage where there's psychological games where they play against each other. I actually was immediately started thinking about Gone Girl with the different identities.
Yeah,
that
multiple had, identities, abuse.
When she cleans the hair dye out of her hair.
Yeah.
And, you know, that reminded me a lot of Gone Girl.
I can see that.
So
I've got a lot written down.
And if you don't pull the other one that I had written down, then I'll
Yeah, you can give me a fifth one. So, obviously, the most obvious of obvious connections is the 1944 film Gaslight.
That was the one that was on my list as well.
That is my number one connection. I think we talked about it earlier. Obviously, it was the first thing to come to mind. It's about a husband psychologically abusing his wife into thinking different things are true or not true, and she basically goes through a whole mental breakdown. I've never actually seen it, but it's, you know, the term gaslight has been used now in modern slang for psychological manipulation of someone into making them think that they're crazy because you pretend that something's not true that you know to be true. That's
or the other, and it comes from that movie, correct? It comes from the title of that movie?
Yes, it does come from that movie. Okay. Yes, it comes from that movie. The other one I thought about immediately, which I know is a movie you and I both absolutely adore, and it's about a con artist who takes multiple roles, has multiple identities, is constantly on the verge of getting caught because they're kind of sloppy at what they do. I'm talking about the Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Hanks classic.
Catch Me If You Can.
Yep.
I did not know where you were going as you were explaining that one, but
we both adore that movie. Fantastic Leo performance. I am also gonna go with a movie about a thief and a liar, and they are one and the same person, and that person is Danny Ocean played by Frank Sinatra in 1960's Ocean's 11.
Oh, the original Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
Okay. I think the newer Ocean's 11 movie has come up before on this list.
Yeah, it definitely has. I also thought about a few other movies. I thought about The Great Imposter. I thought about the George Clooney movie from 2003, Intolerable Cruelty. And then because of The Color Red, I know it's come up before. I want to throw in Warren Beatty's 1980s epic Reds, just based off of The Color Red.
Okay, Reds.
So yeah, and that is what I've got. What else did I have?
Well, I'm glad that you had Gaslight on your list, because that was the one I was gonna call out as well, but I thought you had that on your list.
So. I did. It was the first thing I wrote down. Yeah. So yeah, there we go. So let's go back through it. So we're gonna start at the top, and so we have Hunt for the Red October, A Bridge Too Far, The Rock, The Untouchables, Don't Look Now, The Girl, The Ruddles, Double Indemnity, Gaslight, Catch Me If You Can, Ocean's 11, Reds, Strangers on a Train, Lean on Pete, The Rider, and Gone Girl. So I believe I take first pick.
You do.
Great. And I will go with Owen's suggestion of The Girl, because I think that's the obvious one. And that's going to be my listener suggestion.
Yeah, I actually was thinking about that as well. Let's see. So my listener suggestion, just because I think it would be fun, and I don't really know if you can connect Marnie to The Rock that well, but maybe we can find different connections. I'll go with The Rock. Yeah. Actually, no. Scratch that. Untouchables. Untouchables is a little bit better of a connection. So.
Okay. Yep. Yeah.
We'll get to that. The Rock. There's no reason to do The Rock now. We can do it at some point.
It deals with tax evasion.
True.
Yep. Yeah, which has to do with embezzlement and tax fraud. Yeah, so there you go.
And the organized crime aspect of that would probably tie into the digesting Fargo stuff I'm doing.
For sure. And one of my also-rans as well was just based on the fox hunt scene. I thought about The Fox and the Hound. Throwing that in there because of the fox and the hounds in this movie in the fox hunt scene, but I didn't do it. But it's fun to give a shout out to a classic Disney animated film. So as far as your picks, I want to get away from Hitchcock, so I'm not gonna go with Treasure on a Train, and I don't really want to rewatch Gone Girl, but The Rider has been on my list forever, and so that's gonna be my pick of yours.
Okay.
The Rider.
I do feel like with Gone Girl, I feel like it connects a lot. If people haven't seen it, I really recommend it. It's a great psychological, and it's based on a book as well. I mean, it really does feel like, you know, if Phantom Thread was the updated version of Rebecca, then I feel like Gone Girl is the updated version of Marnie. So, you know, if you're looking for a bonus movie to watch this week and you've never seen it, check out Gone Girl. Sure. And I'm gonna go, because it was on my list, I think I have to pick Gaslight.
Gaslight 1944, because there is another version of Gaslight, but it is not the George Cukor version. So we're talking about the 1944 George Cukor directed Gaslight.
Yeah. Oh, there's one from 1960 as well. Correct. All right. So Gaslight is streaming on Hoopla. Yeah, I do think Gaslight would be a great pick. So what else do we got? Yeah. We've got The Girl.
Yep.
So that's from 2012. That one's on Amazon Prime and on HBO as well. So that one's very easy to find. I do think that would be an interesting one.
I do too, because I hadn't even heard of it. I didn't know that it was a thing.
I haven't either. And I think the fact that we didn't touch on the issues between Tippi Hedren and Alfred Hitchcock just makes me think that that would be a good way to at least touch on that. Untouchables would be good. The Rider has also been on my watch list as well, and have not seen that. So
I think this is a really solid Final Four. I love The Untouchables, but that would be the one that I knock out.
Okay.
Just because we've both seen it. And I also would say that it's a coin flip between The Girl and Gaslight as our best connection. The ones we would have the best conversation about. And to be honest, I think The Girl is the best pick on the board.
All right.
As being the most surprising thing. and is what I would lean towards. But all unless right, you have an argument.
I think we should flip a coin between Gaslight and the girl. I mean, I agree with you. I do think the girl is – it's a little bit different of a connection, right? Gaslight is very similar to this movie. Yeah. I don't know. I would either go with the girl or I would say flip a coin, which I know that's not very helpful. So
I tell you what, since we're doing this so early in the week, why don't we make this a listener choice week then?
Okay.
And we post this on Twitter with the writer, Gaslight, and the girl and see which wins.
Well, because people aren't going to know what the girl is. Like, I'd never heard of the girl until Olin suggested it, so nobody's going to pick the girl because they're not going to know what it is. And so I just don't think that, like, it's not like we're asking people to pick between movies they know. So, Gaslight, they probably aren't going to know either. All right, so I'm going to pull up. I think it's between The Girl and Gaslight. I think The Rider, as much as I would like to watch The Rider because on my watch list, like, horses is not the best connection. I don't know much else about
The Rider.
I think The Rider is about a rodeo cowboy who gets paralyzed, I believe. So
something
it's really
like that. I haven't seen the whole thing. So.
Yeah. All right. So Gaslight, a newlywed fears she's going mad when strange things start happening at her family mansion, and the girl is Alfred Hitchcock and his problematic relationship with Tippi Hedren. I think we got it with the girl.
I think we have to round out the trilogy, because the other one I was going to put on the list was the Anthony Hopkins film Hitchcock, which is him as Alfred Hitchcock starring Star Joe as Janet Leigh, and right. It's about the making of Psycho. So that was an also ran that I didn't even bother to write down, but it was, you know, it's been on the periphery of being on our lists for the last couple of weeks. But I think this is a better choice than that.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so we're going to go with the girl. I would bet that nobody I follow on Letterboxd has seen this movie. So nope. None of our listeners that I follow on Letterboxd at least have seen this. So this will be a new one for everybody. It's a brief 91 minutes. So we've got that in our pocket. It is streaming on Amazon Prime, HBO, and you can watch it on the Roku channel ads as well. So yeah, lots of places to find it. Yeah. I think this is the first Olin recommendation that we've picked
in a while. Yeah, it's been the first one for Olin in a while. I know we've done an Olin pick that he has shared with someone else, but I don't know if we picked a straight Olin pick before.
Maybe The Great Escape. Did Olin recommend The Great Escape? Maybe
he did. He did.
Okay.
And I believe because we've got Thin Red Line. I believe was Jim Crumley. Groundhog Day, Magic Mike Double XL, Full Monty. I'm just going through ones that were listener picks.
Okay.
I think Great Escape is
Full Monty. Is Full Monty an Olin recommendation?
Full Monty may have been in Olin. I don't recall. Olin can write in and let us know.
Yeah.
Let us know. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, cool. After so next week, we're going to talk about 2012's The Girl. It is a movie about the relationship between Alfred Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren. And they say he made her his star and his darkest obsession. So I think that's going to be a lot that we can tie in with the movie that we just watched.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. This is going to be good.
That's
good. And I'm glad it's streaming for free in a couple of places. It's been a while since we've had that where people haven't felt the need to rent it like me. So it'll be nice to give everybody a break, and we'll probably be recording if all goes well and the world hasn't burned down, we'll be recording next at our regular scheduled date, Tuesday after next. So
yeah, so you got lots of time to watch that. Get that feedback in at Ladder Movie on Letterboxd and Twitter, themovieladder@gmail.com for your emails. And Olin, you can record that voicemail and send it to us too.
Yeah, dude.
So
please do.
And Molly as well, I guess by the time you're listening to this, you've probably already
Marnie finished. And the girl. Yeah
Marnie, but feel free to send your feedback, because
Send us a voicemail about both if you want, because we don't just need to hear voicemails from the person who's a movie's picked. Anytime people want to send in voicemails, we're happy to play them.
Just keep them to under 90
seconds. Less than 3 minutes.
I would say 90 seconds is good, unless you've got a really great story you're telling.
Fair enough. Very, yeah.
All right, so next week's movie, The Girl, and a very obvious connection there. It's the story about Alfred Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren, streaming on HBO and Amazon Prime. All right, Brendan, what are you going to be watching this week?
Aside from the downfall of our democracy on Tuesday, probably. I will be sitting there on pins and needles with everybody else. Great British Bake Off has been really, really fun and really good comfort food TV on Netflix. So that's been really great. Every Friday, new episodes drop. It's really cool that they're dropping new episodes every week instead of throwing them all out there and forcing you to binge mode them.
Is it on Netflix?
And then, yeah, it's on Netflix. And they're dropping one episode at a time, which is really awesome. They're really spacing it out. It's been a really fun, weird season so far. And also, speaking of fun, weird, and nerdy, the third season of Star Trek Discovery has been really, really great. And that drops every Thursday/Friday morning, and I've been really enjoying this season. It's got a really big Star Wars feel, and I'm really looking forward to that every week. It's really cool because they put the entire cast into the far future of the Star Trek timeline, and so there's no real connection to any Trek previously, and it's allowing them to sort of forge their own style and path in the Star Trek canon, which I really appreciate, without it feeling beholden to any of the past franchises. It's very unique and very fun. So I'm really, those are my top two right now.
Nice.
And obviously everybody's talking about The Mandalorian returning last week.
I still haven't watched that episode.
Yeah, you should. It's very fun.
I heard it's very good. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah, it's very fun. But my top two recommendations right now are Great British Bake Off and Star Trek Season 3 streaming on CBS All Access. What about you? What you got?
So let's see. I don't know what I'm very excited to watch Michigan State versus Iowa next weekend. Now I'm backing out the Michigan State football season after I was out on it very quickly. So I just watched Dream Warriors as my last movie for my personal letter, and I don't know where to go next. I was thinking I would do Sleepy Hollow, but I wanted to watch that before Halloween, and now we're post Halloween, and I'm like, is it weird to watch a Halloween-ish movie in November? I don't know. It's probably not, but I don't know if I'll get around to Sleepy Hollow or maybe something else. So if anybody has seen Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors and has a good suggestion for a next movie connection that's not just like watching more Nightmare on Elm Street or like that style horror movie,
You can go with anything Patricia Arquette, really. I mean, there's a lot of really good Patricia Arquette film archive out there. So
I did watch Boyhood recently, so
yeah.
I think that's where I'll go from there. And TV wise, just kind of catching up on some stuff. I don't know. There's an episode of Fargo, right? So I'll be watching that. Nice.
Yeah, I don't know where I'm going movie wise either. From Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I thought about once again watching Zodiac, but I try to stop my ladder from being things that I've seen before. I try to make it movies I haven't seen before so that I'm experiencing new movies while also building my film ladder. You know, it's my personal rule. I know you don't have that same rule, but we'll see. We'll see where I get from there. I might just find some random murder mystery or something.
Mm-hmm. Nice. All right. Well, we'll see what we learn about the relationship between Tippi Hedren and Alfred Hitchcock, because we're going to watch The Girl next week. So.
Find out.
All right. Well, we will be back in a little over a week, all things considered. So, all right. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to get that feedback in at Ladder Movie on Letterboxd and Twitter, themovieladder@gmail.com. You can follow me. I'm at BrooksZA on all platforms.
Yep. I am at FidzyBrendan on Twitter or BredFids11 on Letterboxd. Look forward to hearing from you guys next week.
All right, we will see you next week.
Stay safe out there.
The Birds is coming. My most ambitious movie ever. And we want you to star in it.
I'll make you so proud of me. I'll be putty in your hands.
To Alfie and Tippi.
To Alfie and Alfie.
And to the girl.
Angel.
You're not cold, are you? You seem to be trembling.